Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 18th of April, 2012, and it's a Wednesday, which is the new date for the International Forecaster, our weekly conversation with Bob Chapman of TheInternationalForecaster.com. So, Bob, happy Wednesday to you. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you, too. And I would say things are rather at a lull. What do you think?
There does appear to be a bit of a lull, and I wonder if it is a calm before a storm, but what's your take on it?
I think it is. And I think the key here is we haven't heard hardly anything political or bureaucratic come out of Europe in about a month. Now, they've got these due dates coming up. I think the 20th they have to come up. Greece has to come up with money, which is a couple of days away. I don't know where they're going to get it from, so I would guess they default. And I think behind the scenes, what they're trying to cover up here, and we got a glimpse of it today at one of these meetings they're having. I forget which one. And the Europeans are saying, well, you've got to come up with another $500 billion to help us. You owe it to us. And the Americans say, hey, wait a minute. We didn't make the mess out of things you did. You come up with it. You got plenty of personal money, so you do it. And that's why you're not hearing anything about the next step in bailout for Greece. And I think they're at a standstill. The Europeans want the Americans and Japanese and Chinese and others to spend their money on bailing them out. And I don't think they're much in a mood for another Marshall Plan. So I think that you're going to be getting a lot of mixed signals. I just got a letter from one of our people in Greece, and he says that they cannot form a government, and there probably will be three or four different elections. And of course, during that period of time, you're not going to be able to get any information except what's going on in relation to the elections themselves. There's nothing going to be done or said about the debt that Greece is supposed to be paying off. So the problems are massive. I mean, there's just no way they can pay for the six countries, which is about $6 trillion, and they're looking to raise $2 trillion total. It just isn't going to do it. And so I think that we're going to see continued infighting, although you may not recognize it as such, but that's what we're facing. Continued infighting and probably no government.
Well, you're exactly right on that. It does certainly seem that we haven't seen a lot of bureaucratic moves being made lately, and I think that's probably because of the infighting that's going on behind the scenes. But on an interesting and related note, I was writing in the Forecaster the other week about IMF chief Christine Lagarde on her little Washington press junket trying to raise hundreds of billions of dollars for the IMF, which is supposedly going to be the savior or one of the saviors in Europe. And I note in the latest edition of the Forecaster, hot off the presses today, Wednesday, April 18th, you have a little piece on Lagarde and her little quest. She's trying to drum up $500 billion. British sources are now saying she'll be lucky to get $400 billion, and $150 billion of that is coming from the Eurozone itself. So she's really just trying to drum up $250 billion from the U.S., from Japan, from Australia, China, Canada, wherever she can get it. And it's not looking like it's going to happen, or at least not very easily. What can you say about the IMF's role in this?
Well, I think they would like to move control sideways of the management of these monies, but they can't do it. because the Europeans are demanding that the Americans and the others pay more money, and I don't think they're going to do it. It's an impossible task. I mean, $6 trillion? And I wrote about that like 3.5, 4 months ago. In fact, I changed it at that time from 4 to 6. My original estimate 3 years ago was $4 trillion. And of course, nobody believed me.
And
here you go.
Here we are, exactly. So that is a staggering sum of money, and it clearly isn't going to just appear overnight. It's not something they can just print their way out of. And the latest sign of the destabilization and the spreading contagion is Spain, which, as you note again in the latest edition of The Forecaster, is in the worst shape of any European nation at the moment, and is at least as bad as Greece was 2 years ago. And just the terrible headlines continue to come out, not if but when for Spanish bailout, experts believe. The France credit default swaps over 200 basis points for the first time since January. All sorts of just atrocious news coming out of Europe. Can you talk about Spain and it, how it developed into the flashpoint that it is now?
Well, I had one exception. For a long time, they've had socialist governments, and I don't know what the word control means at all. They just keep on spending. And you have these states, provinces, which have the term there. And they operate autonomously. And they have outrageous debts, and they're still making outrageous debts. And so the federal government is trying to stop that, and they can't. It's a part of the culture that goes back hundreds of years. And how they're going to figure it all out, I don't know. But they're going to have to ask for money. And that's why I think the U.S. Treasury and Federal Reserve and other central banks continue to keep big pressure on the gold and silver prices, because they don't want them to go up. Because if they do, everybody will discover what's going on. And I think that's where that's headed. They need money. And who's going to supply it?
Well, that's it. I mean, the worst part about this entire, the way this entire scandal is unfolding, is kind of the slow, agonizing, multi-year-long, drawn-out process by which everyone can be made to invest themselves in the drama, the will it, won't it, of, oh, can they save the European economy, when we know the euro is a failed project and has been from the beginning, and now the cracks are beginning to really show. They're evident for all to see. But as you indicate, if they can keep the gold and silver suppressed, they can basically keep everyone's eye off the ball of what's really happening to these all of these fiat currencies that are being devalued at the same time, so it's harder to understand what's happening between them.
Exactly, and they're going to continue that. It's going to be a rough year for gold and silver. It's going higher. 3,000, 2,000 on gold. I would say 2,200 is very reasonable. And silver, I think, should break out to 60 cents, 65. But beyond that, I can't say, because you don't know which way this thing is going to go.
But what should they be at?
$9,000 and $470.
It takes an awful lot of financial control to be able to manipulate the price of a commodity that much.
That's right. They're on the hook for hundreds of billions of dollars. Or I should say the taxpayers are.
Well, that is the vicious circle that it all comes back to, isn't it? Because ultimately that's how the money is created, and that's where the debt ends up going, is back to the people.
And they're not going to stop. They're going to keep on doing it until they can't do it anymore. And the result will be higher inflation, which they're already talking about in Europe.
Indeed. Well, in fact, on that very point, we did have a comment in from a listener who wanted you to comment on interest rates and inflation, and I won't attempt to summarize the comment because I'm not sure I understand it completely in and of myself, but let's parse this out together. It says, can you ask Bob this question about the prospect of rising interest rates in the UK, or will we see more money printing? Also, I saw Mish Shedlock talking the other day, and he said that although there were inflationary pockets, commodities, etc., we were basically in a deflationary period. He would, I guess, call this a deflationary depression. Do you agree, or are we in an inflationary depression?
He's absolutely incorrect. It has been for a long time. And we would have deflation if the Fed and other central banks were not creating money hand over fist. So from a purely definition, we are in a depression. And what we're doing inside that depression is we're creating gewgaws of money and credit, and that's how we're fending it off. And they will do that indefinitely. And it could be, well, I'll give you a good example. I discussed this 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And what do we get as a result? We got inflation. Deflation did not take over. So you can have people standing by for 10 years to invest their money when deflation took hold. But it's never done so. So they've been wrong, no matter which way you cut it. Now, I expect hyperinflation. When? I don't know. It all depends on what they do and on what kind of volume. Look what they're doing in Europe. 1.4 trillion. And the banks are complaining they don't have enough money. That money went to 500 different banks. So, you put that together with the internal Spanish problems, which is really the provinces versus the federal government, that could take years to sort out. In the meantime, it could default. You've got 23% unemployment, 50% among young people. Nothing's being done to create jobs. And, you know, socialists usually were pretty good at that. Not this time. The government in there now is not socialist. It's what you might call middle of the road, for lack of a better term. And they're trying to do something about it. Could be a little late. I can't say for sure. But I think that whole group of six, they're going under. When? I don't know. But I wouldn't be investing in those countries.
Well, while we're on the note of Europe, perhaps we should touch on the French elections, the first round of voting of which will start taking place later this week.
It'll be Sarkozy and Holland. And Marine Le Pen may draw enough votes away to cost Sarkozy the election. That's the way it shapes up to me. And Holland wants to do away with the euro and the eurozone. Not many people realize that.
No, they don't. I really don't think they do. And it's interesting. I just did a report on Sarkozy and his background, including his family ties to Frank Wisner Jr., who is his actual stepfather, the son of Frank Wisner Sr., who, of course, created Operation Mockingbird for the CIA. Just a storied family there. And some of Sarkozy's literal ties to the American establishment. Quite concerning, considering really the position that he's held for the past 5 years. And we've seen France demonstrably take a rather strange and sudden break with Gaullist tradition and really line up with America on foreign policy in so many different operations, including, of course, in Libya last year. So Would a Holland presidency, would that actually present the possibility of a return to France as something of a, what used to be called the old Europe, the vanguard that was against the American interventionism?
Well, I don't see that, but I do see a very, very tight race. Against that cause, you know what you're going to get. American foreign policy. And you're right about Wisner and that whole group. They're, generally speaking, part of the European elitists. And Holland, I don't know that you expect get much more out of him. He's a communist. Most people don't know that either. And I expect if Sarkozy's elected, the U.S. and Israel will have a greater say on what goes on in France. And so I got to look out for that. When you see something being said, well, is that U.S. or French policy? And that's the way it's going to be.
Well, then probably just more of the status quo. Although, interestingly, it looks like Sarkozy's going to have quite an uphill battle. It looks at this point, at any rate, according to the polls, that he's going to lose in the second round. But still, we'll have to see how that shapes up. And it's not who votes, it's who counts the votes that ultimately ends up winning. So who knows how...
Well, one of the important things, too, in regard to that election, normally Sarkozy would get the Jewish vote. And that's going to be split because Mr. Holland is also Jewish. So those are votes that they might split up 55-45, which would be to the detriment of Sarkozy.
Now, is that to do with his policies or his general lack of popularity?
No, it's just an ethnic thing. But people vote that way.
Well, it should be interesting at any rate, so certainly we'll have our eyes on it. I believe the first round takes place on Sunday, with the second round projected for early May. So we will know soon enough, but we'll see who ends up at that bargaining table at the EU asking for more bailout money. And we'll have to keep our eye on that. But turning to the U.S., of course, you mentioned unemployment in Europe. Of course, unemployment is still a huge, huge issue in the United States. And as you open this week's forecaster, you're noting that U3 is 8.3%, but U6 is 14.9%. So when you eliminate birth death, you get an unemployment number of 22.4%, which, of course, you're never, ever going to hear quoted on CNBC or any mainstream outlet. But a staggering figure. And of course, they're going to try to fudge the numbers and come up with a 7.5% before the election, as you are indicating. But talk a little bit about the unemployment numbers in America and just how dire that situation is.
Well, I see mainline reports coming out of big brokerages and banks saying these BLS figures are worthless. I mean, the unemployment and figures, as well as the figures pertaining to CPI, inflation, you can't use them. So they're looking for another guideline. And I think John Williams has it. And they may end up using his formula.
Well, stranger things have happened. John Williams, of course, shadowstats.com, has done some excellent work breaking down the numbers over the years. And absolutely, it's just a staggering figure. And it's not just unemployment, of course. There's so many other financial stats that are manipulated and smoothed over through the statistical manipulation, which, of course, the average person out there has no recourse to and doesn't understand, doesn't follow on a daily basis, and doesn't know how these numbers are arrived at. But to a certain extent, I mean, do you think that those types of numbers have the same sway over the populace that they used to? I mean, I think people out there understand that the real unemployment number is much, much higher than the 8% they're quoting.
Some of the public and some of the professionals. There's tremendous pressure to accept government-sponsored figures, official figures. And if you deviate as a firm, the other firms are going to say, well, where did you get those numbers? Well, we don't believe the numbers coming out of Washington. And then they're told, you better change them back. There's retribution in that business. You'd be amazed. It's a small business. It runs the country, but it's a small business.
Well, I'm sure you have some stories to tell, but and whenever you want to tell them, you're more than welcome here. But absolutely, I have no doubt about that. A lot of things that go on behind the scenes that most people will never see, I'm sure. On that note, I mean, let's step back from this for a moment, because the unemployment figures is just one tiny microcosm of this, but it raises that issue of the governments that are managing these various crises, the American government, the European governments, that really have proven themselves to be, at the very best, you could possibly say, is utterly and totally incompetent. And I think probably more realistically, you could say that they have really helped to precipitate these crises and are using the political momentum they gain from driving the country over the cliff, as it were. But it amazes me that of the thing that so many people are either rallying for or can be made to rally around in these trying economic times is the idea that giving governments even more power to regulate the economy is somehow the solution. And this is framed around the idea that, for example, the 2008 Lehman Brothers collapse and all of that was really precipitated by the lax regulation of the mortgage market. And if only the regulators had had more power and been doing more, and there had been more regulatory power in the American government, none of this would ever have happened. And I'd really like to get to the bottom of that canard, because I've heard it so many times and in so many different ways. Bob Chapman, what's your take on regulation as the answer to economic crises?
Well, there is none. The mortgage regulators, they, Fannie, Freddie, others, they all work in conjunction with the large banks and other lenders. The CFTC, Commodity Futures Trading Corporation, they work hand-in-hand with the big hitters in the commodities business. And they help them rig the markets, incidentally. You have the SEC. They get millions and millions of complaints. Information given to them by companies that have been naked shorted or front run in their trades, proof of wash trades and parking. Now, these are felonies, some of them. And they do nothing. Nothing. And so you don't have any regulation. It all depends on what the big banks say it is. And we're going to start to see that again on Wall Street as really J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs are taking an even more transparent and visible part of the day-to-day functionings of the Fed in other sectors of the economy. They run it. Make no mistake about it. And they're going to continue to do so unless the financial system collapses, and when it does collapse, they lose their control.
Well, let's take a microcosmic example of that, because there are so many different supposedly regulatory bodies that are supposed to watch over different parts of the economy. But let's take, for example, the CFTC, which you mentioned there, which, as you state in the latest forecaster, has allowed the silver market to become a completely rigged and manipulated market. Perhaps you can talk about the CFTC and what they do or don't do, more accurately speaking, in terms of regulating silver trading.
Well, their job is to make sure people don't break the rules. And they don't do that sometimes. They allow positions that corner markets, monopolies. Silver's one of them. And then we saw the first time ever anyone from JPM speaking about the manipulation of the silver market. I mean, why would they do that? There's got to be bad news coming. That's why. But that's a perfect example. They run it.
They run it so they can reveal it at any time. And as you're saying, for people out there who don't know, it seems that they're ready to pounce on, finally, on revelations, quote-unquote, that J.P. Morgan has been manipulating the silver market. Talk a little bit about those charges.
Well, I don't think it'll be put quite that way. Something like this. We have studied the offsetting positions of JPM in regard to silver and have found they've done nothing wrong, but some of their positions have gotten too big for their clients with concentration, and so they're going to be told to tell their clients to reduce their exposure. Well, that's all poppycock. Just more lies. And they're going to ease up in the silver and gold markets. They have to. It's getting to be front page news. They fought it off for over 10 years.
Well, I think what you're pointing to is really not the problem that there's no regulation, but the fact that there's selective regulation and that these bodies, the CFTCs and the SECs, can come in and they can strike when they want to and against those people that they want to take down, and they can look the other way or make their little mealy-mouthed obfuscations when it suits their purposes, so that it's a perfectly rigged market, that they can crack down on people they want to or let people go, and they get to control that hammer.
And that's right. And they're really controlled by the big banks, JPM, HGS, and so on. And so maybe that's going to be it. I don't know. I'm just guessing. I mean, how could I know? But that's a good guess.
So it seems to me that the real answer to this is not, as most people would say, to give more power to these regulatory bodies like the CFTC or the SEC, or, I don't know, create some sort of new agency that will somehow be able to descend from the heavens and do this properly. I think the implication to me is that what we need to do is get rid of the regulators and the idea that they're somehow descended from the heavens to watch over everything and descend, you know, to deliver justice from on high. Is that really where we're going? Should we be talking about the freedom of the markets as opposed to more regulation? Or where do you fall on this spectrum?
Well, they did this Volcker Act, and it's not going to accomplish very much. And that's just a good example of trying to use the system. It isn't happening. And it's only going to happen in the ways that they want it to happen.
Well, again, I think you're exactly right. They've trotted out various attempts at so-called reform over the last few years. And of course, once again, every reform they bring out can be used sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly, sometimes under the table to really further their interests. And there's lots of examples that we could go into of that. But what's your take, for example, on Glass-Steagall? Because that's a regulation that most people have pointed to, the repealing of that under Clinton, in fact, and the Treasury Secretary Larry Summers. Back in the late 90s was the real beginning of the craziness that led to the collapse. What's your take on Glass-Steagall and what role it had, or should we be asking it for it to be put back in place? What is the real solution here?
Well, the final solution on that is it should be put right back into place. When they took the walls down between the brokerage houses and the banks, they put us back down at 1929 again. None of the bankers knew that. But then they could do anything they wanted to do. Now, of course, that was a piece of legislation that was passed to get rid of Glass-Steagall. And we should have kept it. I wrote until I was blue in the face. It didn't do any good.
Well, I certainly understand that, but it seems to me that the real solution has to be more fundamental than these types of, I guess, playing with legislation to try to keep the bankers in chains, wouldn't it make more sense to be looking at more fundamental solutions like alternative currencies or legalizing competition to the U.S. Fiat currency, the Federal Reserve notes?
Well, I don't think that that enters into what Glass-Steagall was doing. It was really more about the separation of the banking versus everything else. You know, when I was a young broker, back in 59, I had a guy on the floor. I was on the Pacific Stock Exchange at the time. And he says, well, there's some great opportunities out there. You know, they passed Glass-Steagall in 1932, and all of these big banks that owned these insurance companies, brokerage companies, they had to get rid of them. And that was only 25 years after that. And he said, so we have a whole new group of people who weren't here before as leadership. They work for other people. And I said, well, is that good? And he said, oh, yeah. He said, they caused a depression.
Well, indeed. Well, in fact, as even Bernanke has admitted at the 90th birthday party of the famous author, his name's going to escape me at the moment, Milton Friedman. Friedman's 90th birthday party a decade ago, even Ben Bernanke admitted that the Federal Reserve was to a large extent caused the Great Depression by retracting money from the money supply. So they would never let that happen again. Thus, Helicopter Ben and everything that's going on there.
And so that's why you complain on having inflation, maybe even hyperinflation.
Well, there you go. They're digging the hole in a different way, I guess. Absolutely. Well, just incredible. Well, we've covered so much ground tonight, Bob, but is there anything else that you'd like to go over?
No, I think we've covered it for the week.
Excellent. Well, on that note, of course, all sorts of developments happening throughout the week, and that's why the International Forecaster comes out twice a week, Wednesdays and Saturdays. So tell people a little bit about the Forecaster and how they can get their hands on a copy.
Well, the Forecaster is about business, finance, economics, social and political issues all over the world. Published on Wednesday and Saturday by email, and usually runs around 30 or 40 pages each time. We have a hard copy because that's twice a month for those who are not on the internet. And everything you need to know each week is in that publication. The way to get a free introductory copy is to go to theinternationalforecaster.com. Forecaster is forecaster.com. You can also go to forecaster.com. And for those of you who would like to ask a question, we answer everyone, or get a free copy of either, or get a copy of our latest report on gold and silver shares. Email us, and that address is bob@intforecaster.com, bob@intforecaster.com. And for those of you who'd like to call toll-free, that number is 877-479-8178. That's 877-479-8178. You can get your copies there, and for those of you who want to become subscribers, they have a full year, free 1 year subscription to the publication. They have a deal that they're offering. If you want to be a subscriber, that's the place to go to, because it's the cheapest way to do it.
Excellent. And let me just also remind the listeners out there that I am writing the opening editorial for the Forecaster on Saturdays. So be gentle on me, kind listeners. And certainly, if you do have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can always reach me directly through CorbettReport.com. And also, if you have any questions or comments for our weekly conversation with Bob Chapman, you can also get them to me there or on Twitter at Corbett Report. So, Bob Chapman, until next week, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome, and I will see you then.